This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Excellent. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. We've got a full crowd here for the holidays.
All right.
And our listeners are now, this is the week before Christmas. And for those of our listeners who celebrate Christmas, it's going to be an interesting time where you get to see family, friends, and the holidays, always fun. And so today's show is, we're kind of covering some new topics that we haven't covered before, and going back to some of the older topics that we have before versus with regards to dating. So today's topics are about forgiving and letting go, older single women, whether or not they're going to end up lonely and alone, and shy versus bold women. Those were the words of the listener who emailed me, the lonely older single women.
All right.
Shy and the bold men. So let's take it away, Dr. Lyle. My wife has a hard time forgiving and letting things go. She's been burned many times, including being cheated on by ex-boyfriends. This seems to affect the way she forgives just about anything, including problems she's had with family. What are some suggestions that you have for her to truly let things go and to forgive more easily? Sounds like a hyper conscientious person to me. I don't know.
Oh, the man is a saint. I don't know. Visit a Buddhist temple, take a trip to Somalia, at least to Mexico, something. Do something. Isn't this the world full of mindfulness now? Listen, this is pretty much genetic, and it's unlikely to change. So you might be able to change a specific open loop about a specific grievance, maybe, but probably not. The if I was to give the sort of standard feedback, I'd say go visit a decent cognitive therapist and do a bunch of three-column work on this and try to grind your way down through the details of the various grievances. But you're not going to change this lady's personality. This says this is what this is. So she's got a disagreeable streak in here, obviously, and it's a grudge packing gene that remembers all too well when there's been things that have gone against her. I mean, the reason why this chip is in there is because there's a disagreeable streak. So I had a lady that had been cheated on by her husband 25 years earlier, and she was still just in a rage. and I, there's a few times a year when I really get into it, I take the gloves off with somebody, and I took the gloves off with this lady, really out of compassion for her husband. And also to try to help her. So she was highly intelligent, and she must have been, I don't know, 55. And this was, I was probably 45 at the time. So I was a kid. But I'm looking at this, and I couldn't believe it. There was no mercy. And she had done everything that she could possibly do to get it even. And this guy had twisted himself into a pretzel for 25 years trying to somehow even it out for her. Impossible. So I'm not going to say that this lady is a proxy for everybody with a forgiveness problem, and perhaps it's biased my own judgment about this. But I certainly understand where this comes from, and this comes from a specific personality, and you're not going to change a general personality trait. What you can change in people, and what confuses people about what you can change and what you can't, is the fact that people do change. They change their mind about things. They can change from being a liberal to a conservative, or from a conservative to a liberal. Probably more difficult to do that. They can change, you know, from being a devout religious person to an atheist. It's unlikely to go the other direction. In other words, but people are capable of change, and sometimes those changes look pretty significant. But if we look carefully, we're not changing their personalities. We're changing some very narrow, specific set of thinking about a specific topic. We're not changing a wide-ranging personality characteristic. And so something like a person that, quote, has a hard time forgiving, we're not gonna change that. All that we could change is we might change the woman's thinking about a very specific grievance. That is quite possible, and there's going to be times when, with a skilled CBT-oriented therapist, God forbid, stay away from the dynamic people. We will we're going to go 17 layers deep into all the other grievances and the reasons why you have a grievance rumoring problem, all having to do with some terrible thing that happened to you when you were 18 months old. So no, we stick with somebody sensible as a guide, and we grind our way through, or we use cognitive therapy tools that are going to be online or available in books, where we reason our way through some exercises, trying to get to the root of why it is that this is so, what was unfair about it, what are all the inferences or silent assumptions that we're making about the fairness, et cetera, et cetera. So like I said, you may be able to get some help about a specific grievance, but you're not going to change this person's personality.
Now, for forgiveness in general, if it's because someone remembering things, and if it's so bad, what's stopping them from just smoking a bunch of weed, losing their memory, and now problem solved?
Unfortunately, if they've got a big grievance, it's coated all over the brain in multiple spots, so we would have to do major brain damage, so that's not going to fly. But it was good thinking, though, Nathan. So good night, creative, out of the box. Okay.
All right. So on to the lonely older women.
Yes.
And by the way, we have a caller on hold. So caller, stay on the line. We're going to get to a couple of questions, then we'll take the caller.
Yes.
All right, Dr. Lyle, I'm a successful professional female of 54. I have not hit menopause yet, but I'm finding that the cost-benefit ratio to dating more of a cost than a benefit. I'm somewhat of an introvert, and I love time to myself. I work out, yoga, meditate, I eat a good diet, get my sleep, I don't drink alcohol, and I can enjoy a good book. I have two amazing, successful children, good friends. I've been divorced over 16 years. Traditionally, I end up dating men who are between 5 to 7 years younger than I am. Not purposefully, it just ends up this way. But I find that the men I date want to monopolize my time, and then they complain because I'm too busy to see them, or the expectations as to wanting to be number one in my life. I, however, find it so much easier to be on my own and not listen to or put up with their complaining and seemingly their desire to be mothered, and therefore I just don't date. I have my home, my career, my retirement pension and investments. I just can't seem to find someone to date that I really enjoy being with. Where are all the 50-year-old fit and healthy men who have some valuable resources? As I don't mind being alone, however, I'm wondering if I'm destined to be alone and come to terms with it. I'm wondering if, due to the fact that I have had my children and I have my resources, that I'm not interested in any suitable men that come my way because it's way easier to be on my own and do what I want to do. What's happening genetically to attractive, divorced, and successful women over the age of 50?
We're getting some. We're bowling strike after strike tonight.
Pre-Christmas special.
Well, kind of what's happening to them is what's happening to everybody else. Okay, the truth is that you're facing the magic 10%. So obviously, this person is a very solid citizen of the human genetic code, and is a good solid negotiator, which is why it is that the quote men that she just seems to wind up with are younger than she is. Do you have any idea how unusual this is? This is very unusual, and relationships between men and women where the men are younger are exceedingly likely to fall apart. Okay, for a number of reasons. So we can see that what this is, to even get something going like this, it is probably asymmetrical with respect to their overall mate value, and so these relationships don't last for those reasons. So this looks like somebody biting on weak knees delta, and then things not working out, which is fine. No reason in the world why someone can't live their life that way. That's fine. But when we're looking at a person that is basically saying, "Hey, I can't find the magic 10%. Where's the guy that's so great that I really, really like him and he really likes me?" Answer, can't find one. It's exactly the same problem the entire market finds, unless you happen to be in the top, 5% of attractiveness, and then you've got different sorts of problems. Those are what we call good problems. too many good alternatives, can't decide, okay, which I will occasionally run into someone who has those problems, but not very often. Now, so what do you do about this? Well, you do what everybody else does about it. So people differ in essentially how hot their engine is or what their needs are socially for partners. So some people are inherently very, very rewarded by having someone in their life and close to them and sharing the experience. And so those people are more likely to be paired up with people even if the trade doesn't seem that great. Part of the trade is the fact that there's just another human. The other people are not like that. So this is a very stable, intelligent introvert that can entertain herself kind of all by herself, has her kids. Essentially, she's got all these little loops shut. She doesn't have a lot of undone business that needs to be done, and it likely doesn't have a very hot sexual engine. So if she had a hot engine, there would be a lot more going on, despite the fact that it, quote, didn't look like that great. It's okay. It's still worth it. The guy hits like 7 little stars out of 10, good enough. Even though it takes 9 out of 10 stars to get a pair bond, 7 out of 10 stars is enough to have a fling. Doesn't sound like that for this individual. So that's fine. That's just an individual that may not burn that hot in that arena. Huge individual differences in people in that arena, and therefore huge differences in how selective and patient people are about letting people into their life. So what's the solution? Solution is the same thing it is for everybody, and that is that you have to run a CB on the statistical likelihood that any efforts that you make in this regard are likely to yield any results. So many people will cycle in and out of the efforts of the dating market just because they will have, it's just like a gambler of any kind. If you hit a losing streak, you feel like, you know what, why bother? And you may walk away from the table and then et cetera. And so then you go back to the table, win a few hands, and now you're back in it and you settle in and roll up your shirt sleeves for a while. So this is exactly how you expect any animal behavior to work. It's going to be subject to the local or recency conditions of the payoff matrix. So so I would expect this person, given their inherent stability, to basically opt out of the market for significant periods of time, not put much energy into it. And then because there's a natural chip inside of people's head to share their relationship with someone in an intimate fashion, then we watch her circle back around and then make some efforts. Okay, and that's kind of what's happening. The perfectly reasonable move as you look at this as a sort of global problem is to have what I call a line in the water, so that you're making some periodic moderate investments in finding somebody, but you're not necessarily making all the efforts that you could make. It pays to have a strategy that makes sense about how you're going to find these people, which is what I call fish where the fish are. So if you have a particular set of interests, or you have your particular personality, and which in this case looks like intelligent, stable, conscientious, et cetera, not particularly open, if you have that personality, then advertise it and put it on a few websites where you're very clear about who it is that you are and what it is that you're looking for, so that people can read your ad and someone who reads this and finds you very interesting, because he can smell that, can sniff that you are possibly a serious, excellent partner, will be then motivated to write to you. Okay, so, and then you have to get good at looking at the flotsam and jetsam that comes along with it and just ignoring it. So no problem. That's how you do it. You keep your line in the water. And if you do that, spending a very small amount of time investing in that process, then you might hit something or you might not. But at least you have, for a few dollars a month, you've got your line in the water to help you maybe find somebody excellent for your life. That's how I would do it.
Fantastic. Now, Dr. Lyle,
that is how I do it.
All right. Dr. Lyle, can you go over what weak needs delta means?
Yes, weak needs delta is when there's a difference in mate value, particularly sexual attractiveness, between male and female, that the female gets weak in the knees. And so she's more likely to roll over for casual mating strategy in that instance. So when the female is not feeling over rewarded in the sexiness department, then her knees are strong. She's not going to get pushed over, okay? Not feeling weak in the knees. And the male is going to have to work harder at essentially displaying his inner beauty and therefore his ability to generate and willingness to share resources in order to slowly charm his way past her defenses, her sexual defenses, which is what a female is, a sexual defense device, basically.
So, my solution for that is to take every girl to the gym and do a bunch of squats. Then they have weak knees no matter what they feel about me.
All right, let's move on before we get into any more trouble.
Well, I also wanted you to clarify to our newer listeners, because we haven't gone over this for a long time, actually. But can you describe to our new listeners what the magic 10% is again?
I sure will. And incidentally, your audio isn't the greatest, but we're having a little slippage on that, but it's just good enough for me to understand you. The what the magic 10% is that what humans are seeking to do in the mating arena, and actually in all arenas, is that what people are doing is they're a great deal of what human life is about exchanges, and so they're the primary exchange processes that are involved in human life are in romance, friendship, and then in what we would call trade or business processes. These are the three fundamental relationships that exist independent of family relationships. These three relationships, types of relationships, are always operating under the pressure of competition. The job of the human is to optimize the relationships that they have in order to optimize the resources that they gain from those relationships for two overarching problems, which are survival problems and reproductive problems. The constraints that the individual is operating under are time and energy. So the brain is designed in order to make behavioral choices that will result in the optimal time and energy expenditure for the maximum return on the investment of that time and energy in order to optimize the statistical likelihood of gene survival. That's what a brain is of a human or any other animal. It's effectively a gambling machine, and it's essentially handicapping the different behavioral options that it can see, and it's deciding in real time what muscles to move and which muscles not to move. Ultimately, what the creature is doing, whether it's a human or an aardvark, is it's contracting and relaxing muscles. And as it contracts some muscles and relaxes other muscles, that what results is behavior that has consequences for its survival and reproduction. Its feelings, emotions, and sensations are, so a sensation would be something that you taste. An emotion would be something that you would, the excitement that you would feel before you would taste something. Okay, so an emotion is a somewhat different process than a sensation. But emotions and sensations are both signaling devices to give the organism evidence for what the brain believes is the value for survival or reproduction of the given asset that it's seeking. So now this all sounds very technical, but it can really be broken down pretty simply. So some girl has got two dates to the prom. So one of them, or two offers, first two offers to come in, is an amazingly bold and ridiculously miscalibrated doofus that everybody finds unattractive, including her. The other is from the captain of the football team, who's handsome and super popular. And she herself was like, I don't know, homecoming princess or some damn thing. So now who does she choose? What she does is that she follows her feelings, and her feelings are based on her brain's computations as to the mate value of those two different organisms. So the mate value is some total assessment of which organism will be better to have sex with and therefore have its child. So she looks at the two, and doofus doesn't look like it's going to be Bill Gates and a billionaire either. It's not even very smart. And so as a result, she just can't see very, very much value. In other words, she's passing on those characteristics within the context of the circumstances that individual can offer her, and it just doesn't look like a very good deal. Okay. On the other hand, the captain of the football team looks like a great deal. And so as it turns out that her nervous system then generates a motivation in order for her to close the distance between herself and the captain of the football team and to interchange in processes that will ultimately result in a trade of sexuality that would result in a pregnancy and result in a little star for the next generation. This is what life is. So whether we're talking about mating choices or we're talking about friendships, same thing. Okay, girl has two possible girlfriends to have. One of them is unattractive, and she is also difficult to deal with, and she is also not very smart, and she's also dishonest. Okay. The other one is attractive, but fortunately not quite as attractive as our girl. So therefore, she's not going to be a competitive problem, and yet she's pleasant, friendly, reliable, smart, and honest. Okay. She will find that she, quote, likes the second girl and, quote, dislikes the other girl. This is nothing other than a preference that is derived from computations put into the brain by the genetic code as algorithms have been built in order to make precisely these decisions so that the organism statistically optimizes its likelihood of survival. So that's friendship. Then we're going to have trade. Okay. So I'm almost lost here, Nathan, but you help me back if I can't weave this thing back. All right. So now we're going to have trade processes. So all things being equal, we have two job offers. One of them pays, $100,000 a year. The other one pays $50,000. all things being equal, which one do we choose? The one that gives us the better deal, which gives us more resources for finding mates or raising children, etc. So all of it comes down to gene survival. And so then even after you can no longer reproduce genes, or if you don't want to reproduce genes, your feelings are still being run by the very same algorithms. Our girl might be determined that she does not want to have children, but her Stone Age brain, wired by her DNA, still wants to mate with the captain of the football team as opposed to doofus. Okay? Now, where were we? The magic 10%. So in all
trades... Yeah, we're trying to explain the magic 10%.
Right. There we go. Now we're done. Now, so what the magic 10% is that you don't want to trade unless it's a deal. You don't get any excitement. So when you go to Macy's and they say, they have a sign that says, everything today is full price. No, nobody's too interested. You'll buy it if you have to because you really need a new belt for the wedding you're going to. But the bottom line is you're not excited about it. But if we walk in there and it turns out that it says, you know, inventory clearance for fall, you know, everything's, you know, 70% off, you find yourself excited because now it's a better deal, okay? So what you're doing is you're looking at your options in mating and friendship and in trade. And what you're attempting to do is to get the best deal that you can get. And when you get, let's suppose you get a deal that's, you know, you have an okay deal. Okay, well, you're not that excited about it. Then you have another deal that comes in and it's a little bit better. Oh, and I'm a little more, bit more excited. Okay. Now there's a much better deal that comes in. So you had a job offer at $50,000, a job offer at $52,000, another job offer at $55,000, and then one comes in at $70,000. Now you're really excited. Okay. So this is the magic 10% in trading in the romance department is when you feel like you are getting 10% better than you got coming to you. So you feel like you're a 7, you feel like the other person's an 8. Okay? That happens, that generates excitement, and you feel like you've got a deal. The other person, remarkably, sees themselves as a 7 and sees you as an 8. And so it's going to turn out that when both people feel like they are being over-rewarded, that is the magic 10%. And so now it generates a mutual excitement of, wow, you're giving me such a great deal. I feel so lucky. Okay, that is the generation that is the genesis of romance. And so the obviously people at the very top of the food chain, it's exceeding. It's not hard for them to get great deals that are just so objectively outstanding that they're in relationships all the time, but they still struggle because it's they also have to look for the magic 10%. They're not looking for it in looks and brains. They're looking for it in possibly finances, accomplishment, and then a beautiful jigsaw puzzle of two personalities that could, you know, make some beautiful magic. So everybody, no matter where you are in the food chain, if you're a 1 or you're a 10, this excitement is generated when you feel like you're getting a deal. And that's what romance is. Romance is essentially generated by mutual compatible delusions about the other person's mate value. All right.
Well, we are going to take the last question about shy versus bold men next week because now we have two callers on hold. So we're going to take our first caller.
Good.
The caller who called in at the beginning of the show, the caller, what's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hello, this is Brian from Jacksonville.
Brian or Bryant?
That's what you said last time, Brian.
Brian from Jacksonville. Okay, very good. All right, what's up, Brian?
Yeah, sure. I'm just calling in. I had two comments and two related questions, if that's okay.
Yeah, well, we'll see if we give you the second comment. We'll see what the first one is first. All right, go ahead.
Yes. Yes, sir. Sounds good. I just wanted to call in. I called in about I was taking the CPA exam, and you gave me some tips about taking it, and I wasn't real sure if I'd be able to. There are 4 tests. I wasn't sure if I'd be able to pass. You know, even the first test I was looking at. So I just I just wanted to call in to say I applied your strategies and I got the results back in last night, and I passed it 10 points above the score I needed to pass.
Yay!
It with. So, yeah.
Cool. All right, on to the next on to the next step of hell, Brian. Good job.
Yeah,
all right.
Exactly. So, thank you for that. And then
you bet.
My second comment was, I know a couple shows back you had someone call in who was super conscientious. He wasn't 100% sure if his child was his. And you know
mm-hmm.
what they say, you know, mommy's baby, daddy maybe, daddy's maybe, you know. and you advised the man to try and just, you know, see if he could just let it ride and then talk to his significant other if he had to about getting a DNA test if it kept bothering him. I just wanted to point out that you don't need the mom's permission to get DNA tests. You can either get one online or even a lot of drugstores, they have them now, where you can just go down, get the DNA test, you swab your cheek, you swab the kid's cheek, you send it in, and they'll see if you're matched genetically. So, you know, if that's bothering him and he wants to avoid a blow-up, you know, that's one way he can sidestep the whole thing for about less than $100, maybe $100 or something like that.
Brilliant. There you go.
Yeah, so just
okay. –
yeah,
I did not
important.
Know that.
Yep.
Okay.
And then my last question is about the hedonistic treadmill, and it's basically this theory that we have a set point of happiness, and you know they've done studies and they found that someone who's won the lottery and someone who's lost both their legs after a certain amount of time, like 2 years or a year or something like that, they both return to the same baseline point of happiness, and that's influenced by whatever it's influenced by, but it's basically you can't be permanently happy or more miserable than you usually are, generally speaking. So my question is, if you, first of all, I want to see if you agree with that, and then if you do, then what's the point of any optimizations we're making here, right? So if we can trade up as far as income or mate value or anything really, if we all go back down to that baseline point, I mean, other than trying to extend our lives so we have more of the game to play, I guess, so what's the point of any of this? I mean, I know that sounds a little bit nihilistic, but, you know, I feel like it's a legitimate question.
That is a magnificent question, and it's not one that I ever considered. And I am aware of that research, and for some reason, it was vaguely interesting to me. But now that you articulate what some of the conclusions or inferences are as a result of that research, my bullshit meter, of course, goes off immediately, because it's not true. The absolutely, your happiness will change substantially. Dependent upon what your circumstances are. So let's take an extreme so that we can really see it. Okay. So let's. I've got a cat. In fact, I got two of them here. And what we're going to do is we're going to drop them off in a Calcutta ghetto. Okay. And now they're going to live in the ghetto, and everything is going to be hell, and it's going to stink, and they're going to get beat up, and all kinds of bad things that are going to happen. Now it turns out that they are wily enough, despite their cushy upbringing, that they manage to survive and live to an old age and then die, okay? The question is, was it all the same? What's the difference? What's the difference between that and living in this house? Of course it's different. It's unbelievably different, okay? Now, so it's going to turn out that of course circumstances, I mean, it's very clear to me that when I'm in a relationship that I don't want to be in, but I am, you know, through obligation compassion, okay, that what's happening is I'm not sure how I want to handle this. Okay, so I was in a relationship for 13 years that I didn't want to be in, and there I was, Okay, basically deer in the headlights, not knowing what to do. And I was not happy. When I got out of that relationship, I was much happier, and I've remained much happier, you know, for the next 20 years. There's no question that that's true. So it also depends upon how it is, how sophisticated you can be about measuring somebody's happiness. And overall circumstances can change dramatically. So whatever this research is showing, what you're seeing is you're seeing a limitation of a pencil and paper test to actually measure human life satisfaction. It's not necessarily that good. They aren't able to necessarily ask the questions in the way that get at this issue. So that someday somebody will actually peer into, I mean, what they're referring to is interesting. And what the truth of the matter is that when you have, for example, something very bad happen, the loss that's associated with it is traumatic. In other words, it's bad. Your nervous system screams that you just went through a big down hit in terms of your survival and reproductive success. You know, Millie, that was the love of your life, ran off with the milkman. You're devastated, okay? But we're going to find that you will actually regain your feet, and you will once again be in a process of attempting to optimize your situation. And the shock of that is absolutely going to wear off. That shock is there for a reason. Just as acute pain is there for a reason to warn you that there's being tissue damage, so is emotional pain there to warn you of significant losses. So no problem. And then very often what's going to happen is that the person's general circumstances of life, in terms of a person who's lost their legs or some such thing, it turns out they didn't lose all their friends. They didn't lose all of their financial support. They didn't lose their intelligence. A great deal was maintained, and it's going to turn out that their circumstances, and if they're not in physical pain, in many ways their circumstances are not appreciably different, even though they could be quite a bit different on some superficial levels. On some other very important levels, they may not be that much different. So I understand how they could get also noticeable impact on moods is going to be a dynamic process generated by change. So the most acute happiness moments are definitely going to be noticeable as a result of some change. And then what we're going to see after the change, there's going to be a habituation to that change. So all of these things are true. In other words, there's a lot of truth in what it is that they're talking about, but the inferences that you're discussing here, and I have seen people make these inferences in discussions, have turned out are going to turn out to be as a result of some very incomplete science. Now, a corollary to this was the research that you will see that says that money doesn't make any difference past a low baseline. So this was a very interesting finding that was touted, you know, for the last 25 or 30 years, that in the bottom quintile, as you made more money, it had a significant impact on your happiness. But after you hit the 20th percentile in the United States, it was not related. That turns out to be absolutely false. So if you ask the questions in just the right way, or you cherry pick the correlation coefficients, it can look like it. But when you ask the questions properly, it doesn't turn out that way. It turns out incredibly that the correlation coefficient between increased income and increased life satisfaction will actually hold and continue in the same direction in a very close linear relationship all the way between the difference between $150,000 a year and $500,000. Okay, so nobody, you know, this is like heresy. to the notion that income does not impact happiness. It absolutely does impact happiness, and it has a major impact on happiness. And as we step back, it's obvious why this would be true. And the reason is the person's circumstances around resources are better. Okay? That being the case, all kinds of things are better. And as a result, people might say, wow, let's look at this. Gee, money doesn't buy happiness. Well, really? Because people are sure as hell working awfully hard to get that thing that isn't giving them any happiness. And then let's look at the why one would make that inference. And that's because it's not omnipotent. Okay? It's not omnipotent. There's all kinds of people with all kinds of money that are miserable. There's all kinds of people with not much money that are damn happy. Okay? It's not omnipotent, but the correlation coefficient is there. It is not omnipotent that overall circumstances, that circumstantial change is necessarily going to have an omnipotent force on a person's happiness, because a lot of how happy a person is in general is embedded in their DNA. So people that are more disagreeable are less happy. That's just going to be how it's going to be. They're going to feel like they're getting cheated, chiseled, not honored enough, not enough esteem, et cetera. And so in general, those people are not going to be as happy. People that are super agreeable aren't necessarily going to be the happy. Why? They're going to get exploited a lot. Okay? They're going to feel guilty that people are always going to be asking them for more. So when we start picking our way through the big five, we're going to find out that big five combinations are going to give rise to individuals that are some of which are, whose baseline is happier than others. But don't ever close your eyes to the obvious truth, and that is that better circumstances result in better states of the brain, which result in a better life experience, and they're absolutely worth working for. All right? Great question, Brian. Thanks for asking.
Brian, thank you very much for the phone call. Really appreciate it. Our next caller. Caller, thanks for calling into the show, to the Beat Your Genes program. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Molly from Alaska.
Aha. Speaking of circumstances, do you like it up there?
I do. I was born and raised here, and I mean, it's a little chilly out, but I can't complain. We just had a pretty good earthquake, so that was
right.
That was fun.
Sure. Well, what's going on, Molly?
So this morning I was all caught up on Beat Your Genes, so I was listening to Inquiring Minds on the way to work, and they were talking about chimerism. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but that's
say
how
that
it
again.
Was pronounced. Chimerism.
I don't know what that is.
It's when someone is born with like double DNA, so they're two people in one.
Got it. Okay. I've heard of this, but I don't know anything about it. So tell us more.
So I really don't know anything about it either, and this might be sort of a silly question, I guess, because I don't know what I'm talking about, but I got curious listening to this episode. So anyways, they were talking about it, and apparently this, I guess we'll call it a genetic condition for conversation's sake, is actually a lot more common than was previously thought.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently... So they were talking about how pregnant women sometimes can adopt chimerism through, because they obviously, like, there's different DNA inside them during pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, if that happened, so if you became a chimera through pregnancy, would you see a change in behavior, or would that woman eventually, like, adopt the behaviors of the child's father, because now she has his DNA essentially, like, become a part of her DNA?
No. No. There's some science fiction that's going on inside here. So, yeah,
okay.
No, nothing to worry about. The whatever it is that this process is, this is nothing to be worried about.
And so I suspect the answer to this question, my second part of the question, is no, but would you think that a personality disorder like dissociative identity would, like, could that be influenced by chimerism?
Yeah. The this thing, whatever it is that you're referring to, some bizarre situation where sometimes there's two people inside of one person. I heard about this, and I think I was so astounded by it. I'm sure it's, quote, not common. So somebody's making a little comment saying it's more common than we thought. Well, we didn't even think it was possible at all. So if in fact it is possible, it's probably ringing the bell at less than one in a billion. Okay? So that's how that's going to work. Now, the and it's not going to be sucked up by the mom and her turn into one because she's got a pregnancy. So that's out. So now where we are is forget what the other question was. What was your final?
Dissociative identity.
Oh, yeah. No, it's got nothing to do with this. So it's going to be, I'm not an expert in extremely rare psychopathology, but a great deal of these so-called dissociative identity disorders and so on and so forth. There's funny business all over the DSM as people doctors compete with each other to talk about bizarre stuff that they've seen because that makes them a fancier doctor. Okay. So, most of the people that I've met in institutions somewhere along the line will say, oh yeah, they've seen a multiple personality. Well, that's bogus. I don't even think such a thing exists. Okay, so what there is there's highly unstable people that also may be very open. They may also have some, for all we know, they may be schizophrenic, which is absolutely real, of course. So, but there's all kinds of storytelling. I don't know what a, quote, dissociative identity disorder would look like, although I probably talked to 50 people that have had that diagnosis right there staring in their chart. So I never saw anything that looked like anything other than a funny looking personality that would line up on the Big Five just fine. Remember, the Big Five, when we start sliding these things around, we can get some pretty funny-looking stuff. You take somebody super open, super disagreeable, low conscientious, look out. We've got a super creative, wildly thinking sociopath. Okay, what is that? You know, we make them super unstable, super disagreeable. We got something that looks like a borderline. And you can call it that, okay? So when you start... sliding these extremes around, you can get all kinds of funny-looking things and give them fancy labels because they'll do some bizarre behavior, okay? So I've had extensive experience in criminal justice where the people that are locked up are extreme people in terms of personalities. So I have interviewed and done psychological evaluations on literally thousands of these people. And they've done some pretty bizarre stuff. I had one woman dated a guy for a few days, and then this was obviously what you would call a borderline, unstable, disagreeable, in this case, low conscientious. And she drove her car through his plate glass window of his house.
Oh my gosh, geez Louise.
Okay, This is what it was, okay? And there was no big connection, but, you know, she thought that they had such a wonderful connection the night they met at the bar, and a few nights later, he wasn't calling her back, and that's what happened. So I had a sociopath that slaughtered his father, cut him up into bits, and parked it, and burned him and buried the body right out in front of the dad's trailer where he had gone in order to steal money. Okay, it's like not very creative, not very hard to find him, and that was that.
Right.
Took a police dog about 2 minutes. So I've seen all kinds of stuff, and these people have carried all kinds of fancy diagnoses, and that somebody out there is going to tell me, oh, no, Doug, you're ignorant. I've seen a dissociative identity disorder. Maybe you have, or maybe what you can call it whatever you want. What you've seen is a highly open, highly unstable person. with some other, you know, probably disagreeable and low conscientiousness that is pulling the wool over your eyes in order to cover up some kind of nasty behavior that they're doing. A great example of this, by the way, in film, a nice example, beautifully played. There was a movie, and I can't remember, but the actor was Ed Norton. It was Ed Norton and Richard Gere. And Richard Gere was playing a psychiatrist, and Ed Norton is this guy that supposedly blacks out and loses time and then winds up committing these murders. And Gere is convinced that he's a multiple personality disorder, and it's all exciting and fancy and deep and impressive. And then we find out, oh, no, he's not. He's a sociopath, okay?
Right.
A beautiful example of the slickness of sociopathy pretending to be multiples was Kenneth Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler that terrorized Los Angeles with his equally psychopathic cousin, Angelo Bono. And he had the prison psychiatrists bamboozled into thinking he was a multiple. He wasn't a multiple. He was a sociopath. So there you go. Don't know. Not sure. There could be such a thing. But if there is such a thing out there, it's super rare. And it's something, it might be some bizarre psychopathology that is never seen by a rank and file prison psychiatrist.
Okay.
All right. Very good. Good question.
All right. Thank you very much for the phone call. Dr. Lott, I think we'll call it a night tonight, and next
good.
Week we'll go over whether or not men are leaving chips on the table about being shy versus bold.
Oh,
we'll look forward to that.
Sounds good. I'll learn something.
All right. Well, have a good night, everybody. Dr. Lott, thank you again, as always.
All right, bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.